you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
It's society. They work for each other, they pay each other, they buy houses, they get married, make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
I can't wait for the episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire where all the contestants team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
The message of Occupy Wall Street is I would prefer not to play the existing game.
We are a socialist party and there are social solutions to the problems.
Communal lifestyles, I don't know about that.
No one can tell me what to do.
Wow. You're a real anarchist.
And now we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
No words for you puppets of the West. Communism forever.
God, those communists are amazing.
Welcome to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. I have in the studio with me, Julian Dante.
Hello, how's it going, everybody?
So this is the Three Left show of radical left-wing politics, reading hours for post-capitalist future, discussing, analyzing how things work, tactics, strategies, and just how do we get to that, to a better world with less injustice in it. Let's go with the banter. How are you doing, Julian?
Yes, the allotted planned banter. I'm good. A little tired, stayed up too late Friday night, as I am wont to. But yeah, feeling good. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, you've mentioned having me on the show a couple times going way back, so we haven't been able to work it out until now, but I'm glad I was finally able to get on the show. I'm excited.
Because you're working towards being a struggling teacher.
Already struggling. Yeah, I'm a teacher. Right now, recently got a job at a middle school, and in my spare time, I organize with Albany DSA, and I like to do activist stuff, you know, and yeah, that's pretty much me. That's a really lame introduction, but there you have it.
On that note, I think this Monday the 16th at City Hall, there will be our normal city council meeting, but I think DSA is going to lobby for, it's called Emergency Tenant Protections. I think it's just a resolution at this point because I think it's up to someone else to do it. It's always someone else who does it. But Emergency Tenant Protections so that we're kind of on a footing towards rent control maybe. But I think that's the goal.
Did you say that was a city council meeting?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, City Council, we're usually trying to push them to pass our resolutions. A resolution, you know, it's just a statement, it's not binding or anything like that, but we generally understand it as a stepping stone towards institutionalizing, you know, a more humane and just policy towards human beings. So, yeah, we see it as a sort of step towards more concrete stuff. Get our sort of message out there and our perspective with a little bit of institutional backing. So, yeah, the Housing for All campaign has been a more recent crop up in the area. It's something that, like, National DSA is pushing and also Capital District DSA, mainly in Albany and Troy. It's honestly not something I know that much about. I'm less involved with the Housing for All campaign. It's just an area of activism that I haven't really dipped my toes in that much. But right. Of course, it's something we all support. You know, housing should be a human right, as all
basic human needs. We do food not bombs together, and thus we work.
Yeah. We've done food not bombs together. We were recently together with the Albany Free Store and all that, which is also at the Social Justice Center. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a lot of that solidarity building, mutual aid, what do we call it?
Mutual aid.
Okay, sure. Yeah, that one.
Now that we've got introductions out, what's been on my mind, so you do some Bernie campaigning over the last year, was a little bit, right, with the DSA?
Yep, definitely.
I am on the razor's edge of whether or not I'm going to care about campaigning for Howie Hawkins and the Green Party because I'm just feeling not into Green Party stuff as of late. But of course, I always make a case for it anyway. But it's also because of the proposed state reforms that just kind of run me out as far as just they're trying to ban us and it sucks. And making working within the Democratic Party, if you're going to be electoral at all, basically the only option. So that gets us to the topic that I have for us and the articles you've read. From Gods and Radicals, which is Pacific's blog from Pacific Person. It's called "The Democratic Party Is Not What You Think." Now, the topic of today's show is...
I guess I'd say the common thread of these articles is to what extent electoralism is an appeal to the existing structure of power and therefore counterproductive, or if there are certain ways that electoralism can actually challenge entrenched power and, you know, move the needle forward. Whether or not the extent to which, rather, the bourgeois dictatorship, under which we live is a pseudo-democracy, and to what extent we can actually leverage that power towards the benefit of the people.
So the gears are turning now. So the theme is like, the message of this show, which is, of course, nothing is absolute when I do a message show, is all forms of activism are co-optable and kind of inside of the system. So if you want to work outside the system, it seems like the only actual strategy that seems to fit within the values of being independent and not buying in or selling out is kind of dual power, which is building institutions outside of capitalism. And that still takes money, dollars. So getting the money somewhere, but then what you're doing with it and discussing what are the ways that are more cooperative, what is more inside of the, say, establishment roundhouse, however you define the establishment. Between us, that's also the Democratic Party. It's both of the war parties. So the Democratic Party is not what you think. I like this article because it's a very different perspective, and it includes some the buzzword slash, you know, word of the day is cadre party.
Could I just say briefly, I definitely enjoyed this article. It was a really engaging read. As we're going to get into, I definitely had some disagreements with its direction and conclusion and the certainty with which it sort of projects its argument. But it was interesting.
An essay usually does need to, since an essay is usually an argument.
Yeah, of course.
It's always going to project like confidence and stuff.
Yeah, and I love the publication Gods and Radicals. It's a really interesting perspective to attempt to sort of, I believe they put it, a non-materialist Marxist perspective. They, I understand, I think a lot of them are like pagans of one variety or another.
Yeah.
So sort of working intersection between, you know, an actual belief in a non-material world, which, you know, if you're a Marxist, most of them tend to be materialists and most materialists tend to be secular. Mm-hmm. So playing with those boundaries and pushing past them and seeing where that leads people is a really interesting perspective. And I've enjoyed a lot of Gods and Radicals articles. This one included.
I mentioned in an episode not yet released, I'm reading some Taoist anthology, and I want to reference a British commentator who's written a book about like dissecting the long, he's calling it the long 2016, that like the moment, the extended moment we're in.
Oh, yeah.
Since Trump's election.
Sure.
And discussing the Brexit because he's British. And he's kind of said, that like there isn't a new Marxism, like this is the first kind of the revival of radical politics that we're kind of in, that we're being taken part in, is it doesn't have a new analysis of Marx, or, you know, it's not contributing anything. But I would respond with, well, we don't really need a new Marx, we just need to add Bookchin, social ecology, environmentalism, and the development of gender politics and that end.
Yeah, I broadly agree with that. I think a lot of the essentials of what Marx formulated in his work hold together rather well, because Marx, what a lot of what he was doing, especially in his later work, was tracing the core movements of capitalism as a globally hegemonic structure. And given that over the past two centuries, we do still live in industrial capital across the world, a lot of those essential forms of analysis still hold. That doesn't mean we don't update our views as we get new information, or try to attempt to integrate a lot of non-Marxist leftism that has certainly made a lot of insightful grounds, whether it's like anarchism or feminism or queer theory or whatever that might be, you know, things that obviously Marx wasn't working on. But yeah, that's kind of my take on it, if that makes sense.
A good introduction to all of those words you just used is kind of good, like media analysis. I think Lindsay Ellis kind of, she did a breakdown of the Transformers movies with all of those different sectors of theory. So, so going on with the article here, it's not a short one. At first, my friend didn't realize he was a professional Democrat. When he got a job canvassing for progressive causes, he took them at their word. They raised money for nonprofits so they could do community work. Sounds great. During his last week there, we got coffee during lunch break. He told me how once a year they received a list of candidates to fundraise for, not from the NGOs they contracted with, but from the Democratic National Committee, DNC. This meant higher quotas and heavier pressure from field managers. Now most new hires couldn't take the extra heat. Those who could, though, would have a chance to rise through the ranks, eventually becoming Democratic Party bundlers, meaning a functionary responsible for persuading more wealthy Democrats to write checks for the thousands of dollars. Officially, the canvassing firm was independent, but in reality, it was integrated into the Democratic Party, following the party's directives and funneling its most promising employees into a party career. Now, if you listen to Political Common Sense, you get the feeling that the Democrats are hapless, incompetent, and disorganized in the face of Republican discipline. Now, that's the usual narrative from NPR, usual left-wing liberals. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. It basically is a sort of justification to explain why Democrats never actually deliver on the things they purport to stand for.
Right. But that is false. On the ground, the Democrats are a tightly organized party with a strong discipline, much stronger than either their critics or most of their supporters even realize. And unless U.S. leftists, like ourselves, learn how the Democratic Party actually works, their organizing will continue to fail. Two concepts undergrind this analysis. The first, drawn from Marxist-Leninist theory, which is the term that we're going with, cadre party. A high school civics is, stating high school civics is wrong. Neither major U.S. party is actually a heterogeneous coalition. The tight-knit Leninist vanguard model describes them much more usefully. So this is more like a organization that's more like a military organization. That's why the word cadre comes in.
Yeah, that was a key passage for me. Probably the spot where I had the strongest agreement, just in the sense that, like, this is a useful frame with which to analyze political organizations that's sort of outside more routine thinking when it comes to these structures.
Superficial, like, what are they doing in the news cycle?
Yeah. So I think it's a useful analogy and a sort of lens to use to analyze party structures and the broader civil society. Where the article ends up losing me is the...
We can get there.
Yeah, we'll get there. By the way, how's my voice coming through? Am I too loud? Am I too quiet?
I think it's perfect.
Okay, sweet.
The second concept here is the social and political base. Now, journalists often say Democratic base when they mean Democratic voters. However, a base is both more specific and, of course, more expansive than that. It isn't simply that the individuals who happen to support something, like who the Democratic candidate against Trump will be. A base is a durable, organized community capable of directing itself, meaning, you know, it knows what it's doing, in a coordinated way. It's brought, so it has purpose. It's brought into being by a set of social institutions whose day-to-day activities structure their members' lives. So let's go into the definition of the cadre party. According to Leninism, Lenin here, working class revolution doesn't happen spontaneously. Nothing really does. It requires years of careful preparation carried out by revolutionary leadership. So it's top down. Directed, dedicated Marxists who organize political struggles, they spread the ideas, and above all, establish a disciplined and militant organization capable of fighting and defeating the government. Now, that organization, notably Capitalist government, the organization is the cadre, or vanguard, as it's also called. This party pursues long-term interests of the entire working class, you know, so it speaks for it, whether or not that's, you know, its face value or not. It doesn't just let anyone join. Party members must commit substantial time and effort, but also adhere to its line discipline, enacting and defending all of the party's positions. For example, Russia helped Trump win the election and Bernie hurt Hillary Clinton.
Yes, he's a secret Russian. I'm a secret Russian. I'm being paid by the Russian government. And yeah, it's all a front.
So anyone you see on TV kind of using similar talking points, which are kind of easy to tease out, those are the cadre members. Those are the people following the line. They know what the lines are because they actually are organized more than they look. Because they're appear, they're presented as these independently minded commentators.
This is a part of the article I broadly agreed with, because most people don't realize, and the article does mention a couple of these orgs by name, like Emily's List. It doesn't mention Planned Parenthood, but that's one of them as well. Mm-hmm. We see these organizations as independent advocacy and activist organizations and don't realize the extent to which they're actually woven within the fabric of the Democratic Party. And those organizations are generally well known. They have names. And yeah, that's a connection that's often lost in a more standard liberal analysis of the political terrain.
And being a cadre member is a full-time job. It's a profession. You know, just how you have a career that either leads from working as a campaign manager and then your satires do as well, like Veep kind of shows the, you know, the revolving door of being going from lobbyist to campaign manager to staffer to then media commentator.
Oh, and by the way, when I mentioned Planned Parenthood, the point is there isn't that like something like Planned Parenthood is necessarily bad. Of course, they provide invaluable services to.
Yeah, we always give our sides here.
Yeah, yeah, people everywhere. It's just that you're not really going to see those organizations resist a standard Democratic Party line per se.
Which is, we don't run in purple states. We don't challenge Republicans in these states, and thus you lose on the abortion fight every time.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to fight defensively, which I think is Patton put it, you never defend anything successfully. You just keep attacking until you win. When Leninist parties have historically been most successful, those mass organizations would lead to something greater than just a pool of supporters. They'd create a base. So it's not enough to just, because I'm always encountering people who say, look, I like the Green Party. I support them. But they're not in our base. We don't really have a base. Our base is basically the activists that make up our organizers, our campaigners, basically, like myself. So I'm in the Green Party base, but I'm encountering all these people who aren't, even when they're registered Green. They're not always supportive of Greens. There's no discipline whatsoever. It's just like, oh, no, it's whoever I feel is the most progressive in the case. Mm-hmm. And if there's a Green candidate, well, they have to be the right person. And then I try to argue, well, we kind of need to be on the same team here and support each other. That's what solidarity. And then they just like, you know. What is a base? So I've mentioned in a previous episode from like the Marxist Center, which will be mentioned in the second article, that they want to do base building. Okay. So what is a base? And this is great. Evangelical white Protestants, the Christian right's core demographic, only make up a quarter of the U.S. So this is also like the demographic that believes the rapture is going to happen within the next, their lifetime, very day. But somehow the Christian right exercised an outsized influence, not just on government policy, but also on the overall social fabric of the areas in which it's concentrated. So this is where conservative evangelicals are strong. They shape culture and dictate norms, even in places like Texas, where their influence is hegemonic, meaning all dominating. They write the textbooks, but they're less than one third of the population. Where does their power come from? In the 70s, very few people were out as gay. Gay liberation was a fringe movement, even in places with comparatively large gay communities. However, so we just have the example of even the right, even, you know, Christian right. Now let's look at the other side of it. However, where gays were concentrated, they began to exercise influence. They sent Harvey Milk to San Francisco City Council. And over the years, gay and counterculture values came to define the city's image. But San Francisco has always had an overwhelmingly straight majority, right? How did gay people get their influence? How does any minority get any influence in liberal democracy? In the 1800s, Irish immigrants, another example here, Irish immigrants were economically and politically marginalized, even in cities with large Irish communities, but then came to exercise not just electoral power via political machines, but also social and cultural clout. Boston has never been majority Irish. but St. Patrick's Day and Irish Catholicism have become integral to Boston identity. How did that happen? Well, an possible answer. Base building. Even in their core areas, each of these groups have always been outnumbered. In the latter two cases, they started out categorically excluded from social and political power. Yet they all became highly organized forces, dedicated to pursuing their interests, meaning being a little selfish, with vigor and discipline. That let them grow powerful, though selfish meaning competent, which they're not synonyms. But there's always a self-defeatism with the left, leftist subcultures, that we're always outnumbered, we're outgunned, and we can never really win because we're such a small minority. And we haven't really, even in the 60s, I guess, the gay subculture built a base for itself, but the anti-war movement didn't.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
This is broadly a pretty good point about how smaller groups can have an outsized influence upon the cultural scene by having a more unified position and staying firm in their commitments and ideology, I suppose.
Or lack thereof. There's a lot of kind of, as pointed out, like the default in America is like a political nihilism of sorts.
Yeah, most of my points in this article are actually a couple pages in, so that's why I haven't made too many points besides nodding along yet.
Where the things diverge, where they actually propose what the paper, and then it goes into how the Democratic Party is like this. The major two parties, they're minorities. They make up only 40% combined, both of the major parties, in terms of registered voters, not the donors, not the activists, or the people who run for office, or the people with careers. No, they're a tiny minority, but the voter base even is a minority of Americans. A majority are non-voters, not registered, or they're registered, but they're no party. And they think they have influence somehow, which boggles my mind. I don't think, like, they're not even trying to be in a group that has any identity. So their identity is that they don't have an identity, but they have other identities, of course, cultural, religious, whatever.
Yeah. The point is often missed that American, what we call democracy, even by the standard of other industrialized, mostly Western democracies, has very low voter participation. In the 2016 election, if did not vote was a candidate represented on the electoral map, then did not vote would have won, I think, like 48 states or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, at the very most, the United States has a bare majority of people turning out to vote, even during presidential elections. I think Obama in 2008 holds a high watermark in approaching like 6 out of 10 people. But that's about the most democratic participation we've gotten in the electoral system. So there's quite a large swath of people who are entirely dispossessed by the process of politics as we understand it now.
Like, we need celebrities running for office if we're going to have high turnout.
Well, I mean, Trump was a celebrity running and it was historically low turnout.
Right, true enough. So on paper, the Democratic Party is a broad coalition. That's how it's sold, but it's bullshit. In practice, it is a cadre party. It is controlled by professional Democrats, activists, NGO managers, political staffers, operatives, etc. These cadres set the party's priorities, oversee its day-to-day work, and keep any potential leftist competition under control. Not out, most sometimes they do, but under control. Some of them work for the Democratic Party proper, but most don't. Officially, their progressive nonprofit employers, and that's in quotes, aren't Democrat-affiliated, but materially, meaning follow the money, they are the Democratic Party's front groups, the small, self-selecting core users. And it also mentions, in a future paragraph we'll probably skip, that even Leninist parties also have front groups. Just as the CIA has front groups, and our State Department has front groups that fund opposition governments abroad, the nice liberty loving people. They're really just the mine owners. Let's see. No member of a democratic cadre structure would dare deviate from the framework. If they did, they'd risk losing their job. Certainly, their career prospects would vanish. So I was supported for mayor privately by a county employee. Mm-hmm. But she couldn't. She had to help me on the down low. She'd be in trouble.
Right.
She actually supported me publicly and gave me money or something.
Yeah.
And then that hurts so much to know that, like, there's these progressives who don't like the Democratic establishment, but as far as having an income themselves, having a job and being, politically minded, that is how you have to plug in.
I know I said I wanted to skip ahead a bit. Could we actually scan back to that the paragraph at the top of this page here. They align with different internal factions.
So talking about the makeup of the Democratic Party here. Sure, they align with different internal factions. Their competition is important enough to keep plenty of political reporters employed. But the drama of Bernie versus Hillary, or Bernie versus Biden, I guess now, obscures a deeper, more important reality. The faction fights and power struggles never step outside of the boundaries of the party line, Democratic one. Sure, Bernie-crats want comparatively more social programs, and Hillary supporters comparatively fewer. However, none of them deviates from the core program of the Democratic Party. So as far as like, what is the Democratic Party's values? Here is a succinct list, which is actually very accurate. A capitalist economy with some regulation, but very little state ownership. 2, collaboration between the government and businesses for, quote, job creation and social service provision, you know, civil society. Social liberalism, expressed through moderate affirmative action, anti-discrimination laws, official statements of support for oppressed demos, and a few changes to police codes of conduct. Maybe. 4, an expansive military through which the U.S. enforces its global dominance. Nominal support for immigrants' rights, but without full amnesty or free borders. Opposition to expanding ballot access for minor parties. Feel that one every day. And a day-to-day political practice of lobbying, running candidates for office, and symbolic expressive protest.
Okay, so here we've kind of are diving into the point at which I diverge from the points that the article is making. And I think the fundamental problem here is that the author is really drastically overstating their case. It's certainly true that the Democratic Party has front groups. It's certainly true that a lot of protests that appears to be more resistant to the structures of power actually are not. But where I deviate is this idea that, how do I put it? I don't agree with the extent to which the Democratic Party actually controls all of these activist groups and all of these subcultures.
Well, they don't.
Yeah.
But the case is, maybe I can make it first.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. It's a passive influence. So, okay. The Democratic Party and its front groups don't just have passive supporters. They've grown an entire community and social scene around their institutions. Because of that, they shape the social and cultural fabric of the places where they're strong, wielding influence disproportionate to their numbers. Of course, never in red states, I guess. Red states. In other words, the Democratic Party has a base constituted for its fronts. So its base isn't just its functionaries and careerists, but I guess also anyone who's in any of these nonprofits. So that's one claim. Claims. The base doesn't overlap with activist subculture. It is the activist subculture. So here's claim number 2 that we're going to diverge a bit. There is no distinction. The activist scene exists because the day-to-day activities of the Democratic Party's fronts bring it into being, providing an anchor for the informal activities and social networks that surround it. To participate in the activist subculture is to join the Democratic Party's base.
Yeah, disagreeing with that one. And I think you can gauge like different organizations or protest movements and the extent to which they're towing the Democratic Party line. Yeah, I just think the case is overstated. First of all, although it's a very useful lens of analysis and metaphor, the Democratic Party is definitely not a cadre party. Cadre parties don't have a base of corporate donors that are directing their activities through their interests. And when you think of like...
You could be using the word base very broadly. Then.
Oh, they are using the word base very broadly. But also, yeah, in terms of the exact definition of cadre, the Democratic Party cannot be a cadre or a vanguard party in the same sense that a Marxist-Leninist organization would, because they're being directed by a capitalist class more broadly, a capitalist class which also influences the Republican Party. So once you get into sort of that lens, you start to encounter a lot of counterfactuals that contradict the conclusions of the article. For instance, they say at one point that any activist that wants any influence needs to cooperate with Democratic Party orthodoxy and not, or at the very least, not directly oppose and resist the Democratic Party power, or they will lose that support. But that's not true of the Republican Party. For instance, we have a bipartisan war consensus where Democrats go along with what the Republicans want when it comes to military funding, the NSA, the Patriot Act, and all of that shit.
But when I see, and I, as being
if I just briefly round out the point. So, and you have another example, like in right before the midterms, Chuck Schumer agreed with Mitch McConnell to fast track several of McConnell's judicial nominations in so they could have a recess a little bit early and go campaign. Mitch McConnell certainly does not cooperate with Democratic Party orthodoxy in any sense, and yet the Democratic Party still cooperates with them. So I don't think it's true that the Democratic Party shuts out anybody that actually, you know, challenges their power. What this indicates
aren't competing cadre parties.
Yeah, which would really sort of adjust our understanding of what the cadre party is.
Factions within one ruling class.
Yeah, and that kind of, I think that sort of shifts the lens of analysis enough in order to problematize a lot of the conclusions the article is drawing. Also, especially the idea that the Democratic Party is or creates all activist subculture involved in American civil society. I mean, you can find a lot of examples where that's clearly not true. For instance, Occupy Wall Street. The Democratic Party did not want a massive protest kicking off in the middle of Obama's first term.
But it was more, but here's where I'm going to call it devil. It's not devil's advocate. I'm going to advocate for the point of it.
Yeah, go for it.
I've been part of an activist subculture since Occupy. And I know there is a specific difference, and I did think of this as I was reading. Why was Occupy Wall Street had to be brutally crushed while all of the post-Occupy kind of protest movement stuff is more acceptable, more or less?
Mm.
And the difference is Occupy Wall Street, and this is a big problem with the perception that it got in the mainstream, was it wasn't just protests. It was building dual power. It was holding assemblies and acting on its own. In fact, we made it a point not to engage the political, basically the front groups and the party as little as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the original in New York City, we made it a point to exclude and push out any Democratic operative or anyone we knew was part of any front group of the Democratic Party. In relation to Occupy encampments in other smaller cities like Albany, where Democratic politicians were welcomed as speakers.
Yeah.
So what people saw the Occupy movement in their hometown, they saw a protest movement that was aligned with the Democratic Party drumbeat of like, oh, they're doing the millionaire's tax. We're going to fight for a millionaire's tax because that's on the table. That's something the party, we have supporters, we have legislators doing that. The original Occupy Wall Street was anarchist in character, didn't give a hell about what the government was about. It was about rejecting all of that.
But
with the quote of Zeke in the beginning montage is, we would prefer not to do any of this lobbying or campaigning, whatever. We're rejecting it. And so that's why it had to be really crushed. It was the base building of its own base.
Mm-hmm.
But we weren't collecting due paying members, okay? We were just collecting a ton of donations as if we were a charity when we wanted to be a lot more than that. And we didn't really get to the next step because we lost our space.
Yeah.
Evicted by the state.
I'm not as well versed in the details of Occupy Wall Street. I was a college freshman at the time. I wasn't really in a position or able to engage in the extent that I probably would have if it was kicking off today. But like by this article's construction, Occupy shouldn't have happened or gotten the numbers that it did, because it reads right here in the following paragraph that you just read. Anarchist affinity groups form out of protest-based social scenes. Concretely, they need protests in which to operate, and large protests only happen when the Democratic Party uses its fronts to mobilize people. The anarchist scene emerges from the Democratic base and relies on the Democrats' institutional infrastructure. So that last sentence, half of it I agree with. The anarchist scene emerges from the Democratic base. A lot of people who become anarchists or become Marxists are previously liberals.
No.
people have a long process of political education. So there is a real extent to which other more, I guess, disenfranchised ideologies do emerge out of a more standard understanding of politics. But I don't really think it relies on the Democrats' institutional infrastructure in order to exist. If that were the case, an Occupy Wall Street wouldn't have been able to turn out nearly the numbers it did, if it was, because it clearly was not relying on the Democratic social scene, I guess. So yeah, this whole line that like it is the Democratic Party orthodoxy is the activist subculture. We can find a lot of examples where that's clearly not the case.
So as a critique of some of this reasoning, they're really lumping in all protest together.
Mm-hmm. Openly advocating that people shouldn't protest.
Yeah, like because the First Amendment allows for it, mm-hmm. that means it's allowed. It's basically, if the government allows for something, it means that it's okay for them, and that mm-hmm. is absolutist in its logic. It's just kind of doing it A equals B equals C, and that's it.
Yeah,
but yeah. So you're right. Anarchist protests, like the kind of stuff we organize. Especially when we don't involve or we attempt to involve, say, Citizen Action mm-hmm. and these other activist orgs who then basically reject our line. They don't want to take part in our stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or conversely, like say with the climate strike, a lot of radical orgs didn't really participate.
Yeah.
Because the people who were like there and organizing were they were liberal groups. And, and me and another socialist were there, and we were the only ones like kind of wanting to do radical chants or anything mm-hmm. like that. Like we encountered people who believed in like eugenicist kind of politics of like overpopulation, because the overpopulation narrative is just ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And apparently if you listen to NPR and MSNBC, they're not disputing it. You don't have people saying this is Malthusian politics is fascist.
Yeah, this is where
no one says it, you don't hear it.
Yeah, this is where fascism is able to sneak in through neoliberal discourse, not necessarily in neoliberalism endorsing fascist eugenics, but in not directly opposing or sort of skirting around those points. And of course, the overpopulation narrative completely ignores the fact that the bottom half of the global population contributes, I don't know the exact numbers, but something like it's a very marginal percentage of climate change. So the problem isn't the bottom 4 billion people, it's the top 0.001%.
The 1% of the 1%. So here's another paragraph I want to get to. Of course, occasionally radicals do start an organization with the potential to break away from democratic control. Maybe like Occupy, but we weren't under control in the first place. When that happens though,
and a lot of people showed up.
Right. Democratic cadres work very hard, and sometimes very ruthlessly, and I can attest to this, to co-opt it. Even really nice progressive people end up like they go mask off
mm-hmm.
and true colors when it comes to like when someone starts talking about actually collectivizing something.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, no. Okay. So because of its institutional position, the democratic machine can recuperate nearly anything that emerges from the activist subculture claim. Just look at so when I say claim, I guess that's my way of saying citation needed, or let's try backing that up first. But let's see. But here's an example, just an anecdote. Just look at the Greater Seattle Neighborhood Action Coalition. Founded after Trump's election by an ad hoc left liberal coalition, the coalition here explicitly took inspiration from the Rojava Revolution. Officially committed to practicing direct action and mutual aid while abstaining from electoral politics. There's a lot of groups that say they're abstaining from electoral politics, but really it's more muddy than that. With the program on offer, this group initially attracted several thousand participants. However, within a few months, a clique of professional Democrats seized control of the organization by undemocratic means, without consulting other members, since members don't they're not the kind of organization where members have voting rights or something like that. You just have a board or a look at the top. They began committing to liberal lobbying campaigns in this coalition's name, but also unilaterally filed incorporation papers, naming themselves as their officers, as the coalition's officers, which they didn't have before, within a couple of months, because obviously if you have officers, then you're not a war zone organization anymore, more or less. Within a couple of months, the overwhelming majority of participants left. So they don't fight for this because they don't feel attached, like it's theirs, because maybe they're not members.
And the process they're tracing in this piece of the article largely holds true. There's a huge extent to which the Democratic Party and, by and large, the capitalist structure will always seek to sort of appropriate, absorb, and kind of devour any and all opposition and sort of reproduce it in a neutralized fashion. It's it's how the 60s goes from counterculture to tie-dye shirts.
They were promised something different than conventional activism, but the Democrats made sure that this Greater Seattle Neighborhood Coalition didn't deliver it. The U.S. left may not realize it, but nearly all of it is part of the Democratic Party's extended machinery. However, leftists are excluded from that cadre structure, so there's a wall put up between classes. They can't actually direct its course. That leaves them with two options. Embrace the line of perpetual war and all the rest, or marginalize themselves. And that feels like the position I'm always like in.
Yeah.
Now, the Green Party to me is a way of countering that, building a base with due-paying members, which we're starting to do in the last few years since like 2015, I guess. But we keep hitting these obstacles that, you know, the Democratic Party puts in our way.
Yeah.
Like, stealing our line here in New York because of fusion voting, and now just trying to outright effectively ban us by raising the thresholds to get ballot status or to have candidates for state level.
Yeah, the United States is, by its construction, a two-party system, and they will raise hell and high water to make sure it stays that way and block out any emerging organizations that seek to sort of challenge that entrenched orthodoxy.
Now, the kind of charge here that you disagree with, which is very strong, is if you support leftist politics, you need to leave active subculture. Now, a feeling of mine over the last, I'm trying to transition and get out of this, but since Occupy Wall Street in 2012 to more or less today, or maybe me starting the show, I was participating in activist subculture and feeling like I was getting nowhere.
Yeah.
I would try to work with, maybe integrate, or even try to infiltrate these nonprofits, these progressive organizations. And I would just find myself being ignored, being marginalized, not hired. I would just have to volunteer, and basically they would just exploit my labor if I were to feel like I was part of something. But then, of course, I wouldn't be part of it because my more radical politics were just, oh, we can't do that. And I would be in meetings where the conversation was, how do we get the big banks to give us mortgages again? We need like more homeowners. And so we need the big banks to loan mortgages, which they stopped doing after the crash.
Yep. They just hoarded all of their wealth.
Yeah. And that's like, that's your strategy? Like, you just want us to get back to a status quo that was barely worked functional before, and it wasn't really functioning for anyone but the 10 people you were helping every year get a house.
Yeah, fundamentally a failure of imagination. I would like to take a moment, though, and defend my folks.
Go ahead.
us Bernie-crats. Yeah. Yeah, and the DSA more broadly. So, yeah, on the page where this article states the drama of Bernie versus Hillary obscures the more important reality and essentially frames the sort of Sanders coalition left or the DSA as a whole really just as an arm of the Democratic Party in the same way that it tries to define anarchist subculture, all protest, all activist organizations as also fronts for the Democratic Party. And I think it's pretty easy to spot or at least point to several counterfactuals that would indicate otherwise. For instance, let's glance for a moment at Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's campaign. Certainly one of the most successful examples of a DSA insurgent campaign
liberal campaign, because she was helped by a lot of different organizations.
Oh yeah, sure she was, but she was a DSA member. And that was the original organization that backed her. And she was working for Bernie Sanders' campaign before that. So those are kind of her roots. But I don't think the Democratic Party structure wanted their number two most powerful congressional official, Joe Crowley, to be axed in the way that he was. So if you're going to...
With Italian quartet.
Yeah, so I think the claim that... someone like AOC is yet another sort of flavor of Democratic Party or orthodoxy is really challenged by the fact that the Democratic Party, by all indications, would much prefer if people like her were not around. And so even though, like, yes, AOC is working and others are working within the Democratic Party structure, are trying to deal with the electoral system as it's established instead of how we would like it to be. I think there are pretty strong indications that this left faction is actually quite oppositional to the Democratic Party and is able to make some headway anyways. If you take Bernie Sanders as another example, I really wouldn't say that he's just another flavor of Democratic Party orthodoxy, and you can kind of prove it by the way every other presidential candidate has completely failed to maintain backing Medicare for All. Every single one of them at some level or another ends up backing off that proposal, because once you start with the fundamental premise healthcare is a human right, you're looking at abolishing an entire segment of capital from a huge sector of the economy. And that's something that the Democratic Party line simply will not support because of its construction, but it's something that this left faction does. And so that, I think, is a real there's a real tension there, and there's a real opposition there. And that's where I think the mistake primarily is, A, on its emphasis, and B, on part of its framing. If I could put my, like, sort of political science majory hat on for a second, when you...
Oh, you're doing that now?
Oh, yeah, I guess. Sorry.
Maybe you haven't been aware of how you've been talking this whole time.
I guess not. Sorry. Sorry if I'm a little, I don't know, over academic sometimes.
I'm not shaming you.
Yeah, I know. It's just kind of my tendency. That's kind of where I'm at. But no, in political science, there's a lens of analysis called realism. And it tends to look at the state actors or governments as a sort of unifying force and a unified entity, and sort of analyze intergovernmental conflicts and negotiations by that light. But the way it fundamentally fails is... or the limits, rather, of that lens of analysis is in the assumption that the state is a unified entity that does not have internal conflicts or contradictions. It is not directed by those internal conflicts. And I think this article is sort of doing the same thing here in assuming a level of unity with the power structure that actually, when you really look at it, doesn't exist. For instance, Elizabeth Warren. Certainly someone who is more friendly with Democratic Party establishment, certainly someone willing to equivocate to the power structure in order to sort of ameliorate the more powerful aspects of that.
She still makes the donors nervous.
Yeah, she still makes the donors nervous. And Barack Obama, obviously one of the most powerful Democrats in the country, or formerly so, openly does not like her and does not like her candidacy. And if, like, the Democratic Party had this sort of unified cadre, as the article is claiming, then that would have a far more significant impact, I think, than it actually does.
Instead of part of them, say, going for Kamala Harris, and part of them going for Pete, they're trying to make up their own mind, for sure.
Yeah, and then you could also look in sort of the other the opposite end of the spectrum. Leave Bernie Sanders for a second and look at someone like Nancy Pelosi, who is frequently fighting back against the left flank of her own party in order to bend over backwards to compromise or pass things that Trump supports when it comes to the continued funding of ICE, when it comes to several measures. Like, they just passed renewed the Patriot Act, which probably is a big mistake if you want to increase the absolute power.
Can I do an aside?
Yeah, I'm just going to – let me just round out this out real quick. Sorry, I'm talking way too much. But, Pelosi, when it comes to compromising with the Republicans, it's – a horrible thing for the absolute power of the Democratic Party, but it very much supports the relative power of Nancy Pelosi within the Democratic Party. In order to triangulate herself between the Republican Party and her own left flank, she elevates her own power. So it doesn't make sense if you use the sort of cadre party lens of analysis, but when you start to look at these people as, to some extent, independent actors that are interested in exerting their own individual power, that does a better job of explaining certain actions. So that's okay, I'm pretty much done with my point here.
Well, I also want to kind of, I don't like the individualizing, because like I tried doing that analysis for my college years.
Yeah.
And I'm talking like 08 to 2012, trying to understand things by looking at individual like interests and things like that. And it's just like, it just becomes super complex. In fact, overly complex, and then nothing makes sense.
Yeah, there's certainly limits to that lens of analysis as well.
But I also want to point out that there's a, similar to the totality and avoiding kind of totalitarian thinking, I guess, is there's a totality of cynicism of like whatever you're doing, it's going to fail, or whatever you're doing, it's going to get co-opted, that just paralyzes, right?
Yeah.
And gotta avoid that. But I also have I don't know if it's a healthy cynicism, but I have a bit of cynicism from my activist experience. I gave some anecdotes, and I can always give more of seeing it in action, seeing like somewhat radical goals subverted by just the mere act of lobbying.
Sure.
And also just my lobbying, myself, in state politics, just seeing how uninformed and incompetent a lot of legislators are. Like they're not organized at all. Like, and of course, when you talk to those leaders, it's like it's always herding cats. They're not organized at all. It's more of like the passive system.
Right? Yep.
I think it's working passively more than an active cadre party. So maybe that's maybe that's a difference to point out. Cadre parties are very intentional with their line and stuff, but with the Democratic Party or major parties, the passive support of the empire, or rather the support of the empire and the military and whatnot, is passive, because if you actually ask them about foreign policy, they don't know anything.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about congressmen. Mm-hmm. Maybe Cortez she's more informed than these elder congressmen where you ask them about Venezuela.
Oh my God,
they
absolutely.
Know nothing. They don't know head from tail. And they're like, oh, whatever the State Department is saying.
Yeah.
What's their position? Talk to me later.
If they had to point out a country on the map before we were allowed to invade it, then we would never have any wars.
And that's not just the citizenry, that's the congressman too.
Yeah.
So the rest of the article goes into the need for dual power building. And so I guess we'll tackle more of that in the next hour. Yeah, let me just wrap up so we have the last few minutes of the hour. I'll do hourly housekeeping. And I probably fought you in the last minute.
Say again?
Do you have a minute thought?
Yeah. I just the final point I wanted to make about this article is it doesn't really end up having a conclusion, because it doesn't want you to go out and protest and wave signs. It certainly doesn't want you to vote. It certainly doesn't want you to challenge the structures of power in the more conventional, safer ways. It advises you to go somewhere else. But where the article kind of falls short is it really doesn't lead the way in showing where that somewhere else is.
I think this is what I've struggled with for years now within the Green Party, because it's the major question is, okay, we need the base built. We know we need a base. Where is it? Right? I spent the last few years checking our registered voters. Are they a potential base? No, they're not. Is it, working class neighborhoods? I'm not confident. And because I've also gone to the neighborhood and community organization meetings to just listen to people, right? Find a mass line or whatever. And it feels I'm just as cynical about that, because there's no consciousness there apart from like what people talk about is entrepreneurship, and we need more entrepreneurship. Capitalist economics.
Yeah, capitalist realism.
There's authoritarian attitudes like conservatism. But anyway, in black neighborhoods and of course in liberal neighborhoods, in liberal communities, there's a conservatism there where they don't want to use they-them pronouns, or it's like it's alien to them. But I'm not just talking about gender stuff. I'm also talking about the economics of like a city-run a city-run enterprise is just as alien to them as trans rights. But Gods and Radicals is written by, you know, communist polytheists in the Pacific Northwest. So
maybe it's a good publication overall.
Yeah.
I got the stone in my side. I got the boogeyman child. I know just what to do. We gotta take back the throne. We'll let the kids rock and roll. I know just what to do. Yeah, and take me home. Place we understand where the cold winds blow and revolutions in the air, and all we know, we're fighting for what we have. Fight the good fight, fight the good fight. Now war is declared. Get back to square. I know just what to do. Not gonna swallow my pride or do a Jekyll and a Hyde. I know just what to do.
Welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, with Julian Dante.
Dan Platt of the Three Lefts Show.
Talking. So I have another article here that comes, kind of does a similar thing. Oh, yeah, also critical of the essay. So, but this is why I like
that. Oh, no.
You can respond.
Yay.
I'm not so good. It comes to the same kind of conclusion of base building / dual power building as being like the possible winning strategy going forward, because we spent the last decade basically doing everything else, hitting our heads against the wall and making some progress here and there. You know, there's always victories to shout out, and we should always celebrate every victory, no matter how small. But it never feels like, to me, system change, forgetting the potential of system change. So for the Union Marxists, for the unity of the dispossessed, from Cosmonaut, publication, So this is about, so it starts with a mentioning of some in the DSA Nationally's internal politics. So up close, the DSA Bread and Roses, the centralizers, the DSA Build Caucus, the decentralizers, and the Marxist Center look pretty different. What do a unified social democrat faction, a loose opposition alliance, and an aspiring cadre party have in common? Let's step back a few feet, though, and their distinctions lose significance, like the different colored dots of an impressionist painting blending into a coherent whole.
Solid metaphor.
Class, I don't think it is.
I don't know. I like impressionism.
Okay. Sure. But they're mentioned, they're, pointillism is what they mean to say, not impressionist, a pointillist painting.
Oh, yeah, they do say dots, don't they?
That's the problem when political scientists want to use art metaphors. It's not...
Yeah, we're stupid.
That, you got to be interdisciplinary. Got to be interdisciplinary. Take us through this. Okay.
Pointillism is a subgenre of impressionism, right? The pointillist painters were considered impressionists.
Okay. Fine. It's accurate on a technicality.
Cool.
Class is everything. Let's get some classist analysis in here. A libertarian professor of economics and a radical professor of women's studies may hate each other, so you know, in the culture war, but they both make five times as much as the janitor who cleans up after them. And more importantly, they spend their lives in the same educated, affluent, and milieu, meaning circumstances. Despite its egalitarian pretensions, the U.S. political system is run by a middle class or a professional one for the benefit of a ruling class. Ruling class doesn't actually manage things. They leave it up to managers. There is effectively no political culture outside of those classes. So there's that claim again that there's nearly nothing outside of a professional culture. And, oh, except for a few isolated and localized examples, notwithstanding, meaning mutual aid projects like UDFOs. Of course, the dispossessed do resist their dispossession all the time, but they do so outside of the political system and usually in limited decentralized ways. Thus, they don't make headline news. Everyday oppression and everyday resistance tending towards a socially stable equilibrium. So it's like that. There's that cynical take again of like, there's really nothing outside of the society. We're in it and we can't break out. Okay. But U.S. socialism itself is a fringe of the political, of the official political culture. So like we're still in it, you know, in the Overton window, even though we're trying to push outside of it or whatever. Its class makeup reflects that. It is college educated, guilty, affluent, or at least to affluent parents, a little guilty, and attuned to the concerns of middle class professionals and students in general. Wherever there's door knocking for Bernie, waving anti-imperialist placards for the cameras, and running brake light clinics, mutual aid stuff even, it's the same people from the same backgrounds mobilizing each other. In other words, should they arrange themselves into a centralized electoral front, a federation of autonomous activist hubs, or an ideological united party, like the Marxist Center wants to do? Shouldn't they first, or even the Green Party, but we're not really good at uniting anyone, we ask people to unite with us and they just say, no, we're doing our own thing. We want to keep our options open and we don't want to piss off the Democratic Party functionaries. Shouldn't they first prove why they, as a subculture, matter in the first place? This person's like talking on the outside, but they're inside of it too, just being critical. Normcore social democrats and social reproduction theory feminists both claim to represent the authentic working class.
Normcore.
You have never heard that before?
No, I have. I just like that. I just.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's just funny.
Don't hear it enough.
Yeah.
I just remember the last time I saw normcore as a meme, it was basically with Mitt Romney and his style.
The dreaded.
So if you want to think, was normcore? Think of Sarah Palin and Mitt Romney and their fashion sense and what they wear and how they act. That's normcore.
Weirdos.
Yeah, it's very weird. It's basically the lack of any kind of like, I'm fitting in. If that's true, why do both sides seem to be made up mostly of journalists and humanities postdocs? Sweat. Where are the call center workers? Where are the home health aides? Well, they are unionizing. Where are the McDonald's fry cooks? Everyone talks about them. But when was the last time you saw one running an activist meeting?
When I was a home health aide, I was in Millbrook, New York, and there were no activist meetings. So, womp womp.
Yeah, this writer, I want to point out, super critical of a cub culture that there, of course, is their world. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of in their own bubble of sorts, kind of missing the point that in many parts of America, there isn't any social activist scene at all. Like Albany has one because we're the capital. And so it's like a lot of our subculture is actually activist subculture.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like both it's a two-sided sword kind of thing, I feel. But no, wrong analogy. But it's really bad in the places where there's just no activist meetings at all. And just the fact that, and it's where people, it's mostly like, you also get the feeling that it's where like you could start fresh. Like you go mm-hmm. to Kansas, and when you start a socialist meeting, it's the first like different thing that is out there. So you get a lot more interest, or it's, you have people without the activist biases that this guy is kind of representing in some ways.
Right, right.
That like fry cooks aren't organizing. Well, the IWW does that mm-hmm. When they can in certain cities where they exist.
And they strike.
Exactly. Militant stuff. Traditionally, Marxism draws... Yeah, the 5 for 15, that was McDonald's workers. Don't
yeah, yeah. When
it
you're,
was brief, but they did it.
When you're of a working class background, your political organization and participation tends to be geared towards the fact that your back is against the wall. And so the organizing will be kind of limited in its purview to whatever is going to alleviate the immediate suffering.
Right.
So, yeah, you're not going to necessarily see the McDonald's workers holding the anti-imperialist placard. Certainly some of them will. This isn't to sort of dismiss the political orientation of working class folks and like minimum wage workers.
Yeah. How does it get the system change? You know, that's kind of the puzzle. But is there even an answer to that puzzle? Is it the wrong question? Likely is. But here it is. These days, U.S. leftism has lost that awareness, working class awareness. Let's skip the paragraph. Traditionally, Marxism draws a line between intellectuals and the proletariat, meaning the actual, the possessed, unskilled labor. The latter, not the former, carries the revolutionary seed. So that's kind of a claim. Both because it owns no means of production and thus has no stake in preserving the class system in the first place. And because of the logistically socialized large-scale economy, it operates, makes it possible to raise everyone's standard of living.
Now, this yeah. part's kind of interesting because my reading of Marx is a little different. And there's definitely like a lot of Marx I haven't read yet. I'm currently going through my like first read-through of like Das Kapital, Volume 1.
Have you read Critique of the Gothma Program?
Maybe. I don't know. At first I had I had my Marx Engels reader, which is a nice like primer if you're interested in Marxism and you know don't have the time to read like 9,000 pages of stuff.
Yeah,
because it'll have a couple hundred pages of the Grand Risa and like essential passages and stuff. So like that's mostly what I've read. But anyways, the point on Marxism here, like I don't think intellectuals own the means of production by a Marxist standpoint. The means of production are pretty clearly like the factories, the larger property system.
Yeah, class doesn't own anything except maybe their own house, but then the bank kind of owns the house via work.
Yeah, like I get the point more broadly that like the middle class are often largely like functionaries of the bourgeoisie. For example, like the manager on the factory floor, even though he doesn't own the means of production, he's still co-opted by the capitalist system by a comparatively advantageous position. But still, under a Marxist definition, like the proletariat is pretty much everybody who's not the very narrow capitalist class. Now, that makes an interesting little point here that
that's what the guy is arguing, that like there's this false distinction being made where saying that like professors are also workers, and it's like this is wrong, which
I think professors are workers. They're comparatively advantaged ones. We know that within the broad umbrella of the proletariat,
yeah.
there is a million different iterations and subdivisions, and that's to the service of capital to be able to divide the proletariat against itself, to give a segment of the proletariat a bit of a stake in the system in terms of, I don't know, licensing or professional training is what it mentions here, is the thing that these middle class professionals, you know, own, so to speak, that unskilled laborers don't have that same kind of stake in the system. So yeah, that all scans to me. But where I'm kind of losing the thread here is that like the middle class is generally like this kind of artificial distinction that
and we also talk about how it's shrinking. We mean it's shrinking because the professional class is now struggling just like any other worker now.
Yeah, these are people with material advantages, certainly, but what they don't have is power. Like, they don't have ownership over the means of production, which would make them, by my understanding, proletariat and not capitalist. So that's, well, I'm kind of
to put it in a micro sense,
losing it here.
They do have power in, like, I'm not saying microaggression, but, like, in these micro instances of, like, having the ability to shop in the first place, to go to restaurants and then demand to talk to the manager when the service is not just perfect.
Yeah, consumer power, certainly. I would look at that as a...
It's very minor, of course.
Yeah, it's more of an advantage because when
I... feel powerful when they can buy. Like, there's a type of shopping addiction is like not just the hit of dopamine, but just the feeling of control.
Yeah.
In buying things when there's really no other control that you might have.
I just wouldn't necessarily call it power if the person that actually owns the stuff and is running the show can take it away from you at any point that they want to. That to me is a privilege and an advantage, which to me is distinct from power. And again, I'm not claiming that the middle class are professionals. I'm certainly a member of the middle class, and I have a social safety net that many people are denied, even though I make the wage of like a working class person. Sure. I'm younger and all that, but if push comes to shove and there's an actual emergency though, I can fall back on, family members. So, and that's an advantage that not everyone has. So that distinction definitely holds true. And when I'm giving this kind of definition of this different understanding of proletariat, I'm not trying to deny that privilege exists, certainly.
Of course. So the next paragraph kind of echoes that thing of these days, U.S. leftism, trademark, has lost that awareness. To hear any faction of the DSA talking about you. Talk that K-12 teachers like Julian.
Yeah.
College professors and even professional athletes are like Kaepernick, are proletarians. Instead of dedicating their lives to serving the masses, intellectual class radicals would rather band together with each other and creatively redefine the proletariat to include themselves. While they may fool
like
each
I was
other,
just trying to.
Yeah. They can't fool the larger social process of class struggle. You know, that conscious abstract thing.
I'm not fooling them.
Yeah, you're not fooling God.
I'm not fooling them, Dan.
You can't fool God.
Oh, no.
This is where it becomes like this kind of type of like totalitarian thinking. I mean, it's you know, it has dogmatic flavors. But it's all part of the same middle-class protest movement.
Yeah, because the K-12 teacher doesn't own the classroom. It doesn't own – they don't own the –
they don't determine the curriculum.
Yeah, they don't own the means of production. So, like, they have advantages, but that's not the same as having power. And what the capitalist class has is power.
So, yeah, so
I don't know.
We're undercutting the premises of this article, but that's kind of why I like discussing it, because it's a conversation that even radical left isn't having properly.
Yeah, and there's definitely like parts of Marx I haven't read yet. I just wish I knew like what this person was referencing exactly. I think it would maybe clarify.
They're not referencing Marx
directly, not referencing where they're
reading text. They're referencing 20th century interpretations that have come about. Like, say, a situationist just like takes Gramsci's or the Frankfurt School's interpretations and just runs with it.
And I love the Frankfurt School.
And of course. We all do. But there's a problem with just taking one tendency or one interpretation or one take and just that's your take too. And then you don't read anything. Like, there are these leftists online, particularly, like, maybe they're all teenagers, so, like, they're just young. They just read one thing, and that's their world now.
Mm-hmm.
Just like how a teenager can read the Fountainhead, and then they're a libertarian for life. There's, like, someone who reads Guy Debord, and it's like, that's it. And they interpret everything that way, and they don't have anything else. And then they get really annoying real fast, because then they get really kind of bland, if not interesting takes to outsiders or others, but then after a few years of banging their head against the wall, they just end up being really cynical and thinking nothing will work.
Yeah, you go
into a depressive stupor, which I'm sure I've encountered enough of those people as well.
Sure. Yeah. I think it's far more useful in general to understand Marxism, socialism, communism as a sort of 200 plus year old revolutionary and intellectual tradition that has this huge variegated range of different inputs and formations, rather than a sort of doctrinal unitary understanding of what it is. I mean, just because it's called Marxism doesn't mean we just, you know, worship Karl Marx. Hopefully it doesn't mean that.
That's what Fox News thinks. So, but here's where the person isn't just some dogmatic show. Okay, now, as an individual, there's nothing morally wrong with being an intellectual. That's my class background, says the writer. And if you're reading this, there's a better even chance that yours is too. Guilty. Intellectuals can contribute plenty. They have administrative, research, fundraising, and bookkeeping skills. Extra time and energy. Now, of course, these skills need to be distributed and so on and whatever for a horizontal organization. Now, if intellectuals go to the proletariat, immerse themselves in it, dedicate their lives to it, and help organize and low-wage workplaces and slumlord-owned buildings, projects CSA is taking up, they can be a truly valuable part of the class struggle. And historically, red unions and communist parties have always attracted their fair share of radically-minded intellectuals. Usually their leaders are them. Many of them have brought social, scientific, and so on. However, the U.S. actually existing socialist groups at the moment are there for their own sake, not as supporting organization, organizers for struggle committees, but their understanding of the mass as anyone who shows up to a protest, which when I work with people like this, like maybe Citizen Action, like I get really bummed out because like they really gauge their momentum and success based on when they organize an action, how many people showed up. And
yeah.
I was kind of stuck in this mode of thinking for 2 years, and I had to get out of that mindset real fast because it was driving me crazy.
Yeah, it's certainly an indication of support, but over leaning on that can risk losing the forest for the trees.
I didn't know what else to do at the time because I was, but I also was actually working a full time job, so I just had less time to think about it, I guess. And I just wanted to keep occupied going, but it was not via actual like street assemblies and the things that made Occupy, but just as a protest movement, which of course I knew it was more than that, but I figured there needed to be protests to get people back into the park, because otherwise you have plenty of people saying, we need to reoccupy the park, but then they wouldn't do it, or they wouldn't call, like they wouldn't organize it, because they were, I can't give an analysis, I guess.
Yeah, I agree with the
psychology gets into it.
I agree with a big part of the sentiment of these two articles we've looked at so far, in the sense that a lot of people and political organizations tend to see, like, I don't know, either just showing up at the ballot box or having a protest as like the end all or like the end point or the culmination of their political advocacy and action. That sort of being the point. It really has to be a component of something that's a broader vision. But where I end up disagreeing is the conclusion they draw that therefore don't protest, since protest is not in itself going to solve the problem. Therefore, don't do it. Like, I see it as a pretty integral component to like make people aware, to temporarily disrupt the normal order of things. I just see it as useful.
So let's skip to the last few paragraphs where they kind of put a way out, just like the last one. It's pretty much the same answer, but put a different way. So instead, the way forward is to steadily and patiently gain experience with class struggle, which of course is very vague, gradually cultivate a base among the dispossessed, and we can then define dispossessed for ourselves, meaning anyone who's basically exploited, I would say, and eventually begin to develop the necessary forces to establish our own sovereignty, revolutionary or otherwise. Not joining the official political realm, but creating an entirely new one. This is called dual power. I spent years in the middle class activist left, including as an early Marxist center organizer. And these are the people who say they're base building. I don't write this to set myself up in doing this. So this person left the Marxist center, I guess, which what makes doesn't really say. Well, I guess this article is saying like the Marxist Center is still just doing the same old thing. Yeah. I don't write this to set myself up as the embodiment of some kind of virtue that others lack. Everything I've been speaking here, I was doing myself for 2 years. Only 2 years. Try for six. When I call it a dead end, I'm not talking from ignorance. But I left. I changed the type of organizing I'm involved in, and more importantly, the constituency towards which I orient. Now, they don't dive into this. I wish they would.
Yeah, I really wish
Who are they organizing with?
Yeah, them? I wish this wasn't the last paragraph of the article, because like, if you, like, because these articles are both sort of painting the entire activist subculture and several forms of political organizing as just sort of within the web of hegemonic capital, which, sure, capitalism is a global and totalizing system that includes everything around you within its ideological auspices. So there is definitely a distressing degree to which it's sort of impossible to fully leave or like branch outside of the capitalist structure as you're challenging it, because there's kind of not an outside to go to at the moment. But then they both articles indicate that they have done that, that they have found this kind of outside that isn't the things they're pointing at. But I never get an indication of where it is.
For some reason, this makes me think of Captain Fantastic. Did you ever see that movie?
I love that movie.
Yeah. So that was the case.
That movie is funny.
Even when you're in the isolated cabin in the woods, like, you're still in America.
Yeah, of course.
And the message of the movie is like totally isolating yourself from everything is not a healthy thing to do.
Mm. I thought the message is that what's the actor's name? The main actor?
Viggo Mortensen.
I thought the message of that movie was that he's a great dad.
He is a great dad.
Yeah.
He was also overcome with grief, though.
Yeah. So, I would love to get raised by him. Have like martial arts skills.
Learn how to knife fight.
Yeah.
We need to do that ourselves. And of course, our fellow socialists are itching to do that, though.
Knife fight?
Not knife fight.
I don't want a knife fight.
They did a workshop on how to buy a handgun.
Okay.
And get a handgun license. But otherwise, dope. They...
See, I don't know. Yeah,
so, a lot of these articles are always pretty big. So sometimes I think they do say, like, tenant organizing, you know, and then I see DSA groups or other socialists and other types of organizations of various flavors doing that. And I'm like, well,
yeah, why doesn't
is that out? You know,
why don't we count?
Is that, yeah. So it seems.
Come on, guys. We're not that bad.
Yeah. Well, if the reform goes through in the coming spring session, I probably will switch over to DSA.
Dope.
I'm just thinking about it.
Come on over. Welcome to the team. Let's get some converts. Oh, yep. No problem. Okay. So those were the two articles on Marxism and protest and stuff. Let's move on to this next Guardian one. Can we take a look at that one too? What makes me tired when organizing with middle-class comrades?
This follows up on the...
I mean, all the articles are making...
It's not redundant, but it's making similar points about...
Yeah, all the articles are making some good points that I definitely agree with. We, have explored ad nauseum the kind of the limit points that these articles hit. This one I liked a bit.
It's okay
more.
To repeat stuff. I think the problem with NPR reporting and stuff is like 5 minutes and the story's gone.
Yeah.
And in a week, you'll forget you heard it.
Yeah.
Unless it really said something that spoke to you, but then it has to interact with something that's already in your life.
Yeah, that one podcast, Citations Needed, I think it's called. They do like media crit stuff. They at one point made this really interesting point how CNN does a similar thing. Like, one of the best mechanisms they have for enforcing the very superficial level of analysis that they're constantly employing, despite being on 24 hours a day, is that they narrow everything to 30-second sound bites. Yeah. You can never have an like in-depth sort of
even a 10-minute conversation. Yeah. Like the Real News Network does is better.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's a very like crafty way that they enforce a sort of a political amnesia. Totally. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's the phrase I've heard. Also, while we're in the segue, I want to mention like these two points in my life and my college experience that radicalized me. Maybe three. The first was in 2010 when the Democrats basically helped renew the Patriot Act. That's basically when the sham of the progressive wave just kind of came to, like, it was just, like, they're not just dragging their feet, they're actively just continuing everything that we were mad about.
Yeah, they spend all this time talking about, you know, accurately, how Trump is, you know, a deranged psychopath. He has dementia. He's not mentally stable. He openly talks about how he wants to be a dictator. He's definitely a fascist. But then when it's time to re-up his just radical expansion of executive power, they just uncritically do so. It's just like, why do you want Trump to have, like, the NSA?
Because they want the next Democratic president to have that power, too. And it's just like, it's, they just don't. It just doesn't matter. It's, they're both on the same team.
Yeah, they just, they're just, like, a lot of so, the centrists are just only superficially interested
in. Not to contradict what we said in the first hour. Yeah. So, point two, so that was, 2010 was when I left the Democratic Party and made a decision to, like, not want to be involved with the superstructure they have, you know, which is very, very, very difficult. It means you have to say no or distance to a lot of people. But now I get the ooglies when I'm in those spaces, which, I get really nervous when I see more of those functionaries in this studio, in this building.
Yeah.
Cause then it's like, well, how long before, like, I'm going to basically be pushed to the side because I criticize the party a lot more and I'm offending my fellow, like, broadcasters who have their show. But anyway, but that's personal and probably paranoid.
Yeah. I don't know.
As a community organization that's all volunteer, I don't think that's going to happen. So, counterpoint. A second story of, so when others prepared for their careers in architecture, I took theory courses. And one of them was Words and Buildings, where we just read other types of theory, like gender theory, whatever, talking about space and cities and stuff. And one of the readings was an excerpt from Engels' Conditions of the Manchester Working Class.
A classic.
Yeah. And
his breakout album. If you will.
And it was just like 10 pages of him discussing like the slums of Manchester. And the conditions are nightmarish, worse than even Dicksonian stuff. Maybe I just haven't read all of
Dickens.
Dickinson. Yeah, Dickens.
Are you talking about Charles Dickens or Emily Dickinson?
Charles Dickens.
Yeah, Charles Dickens. Yeah.
I got it confused. But a phrase he used multiple times that really stuck with me was like, something has to be done. He wasn't just describing it. As any Marxist would say, it's not just to describe things, but to do something about it.
Yeah.
And he kept repeating, like, isn't this horrible? Something has to be done. Now, in my mind, knowing a little bit in 20th century history, the thing he's referring to is socialism. But until that point, I was just a left-leaning liberal.
Yeah.
But reading that, and this was maybe the first kind of, the first step to moving in the political spectrum or whatever, is what is justifiable? You know, questions of violence, questions of revolution, is system change justifiable? These are the primo questions. And to me, was socialism justifiable? Mm. And reading Engels, you know, that just an excerpt of it, suddenly it just, that was the switch of like socialism as a concept and political like stance was now justifiable to me. Because all the reformism of the Dickens era just wasn't doing it.
Yeah.
And all the goodwill, capitalists or whatever, was like, this is still the conditions. Mm-hmm. Just as today, we have terrible slumlord conditions.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, and so it's like socialism is the answer. And that's, or rather, it just became justifiable. And then I could start investigating because I hadn't really had the opportunity or the wherewithal to investigate what socialism means.
Mm-hmm.
I need to know what it means first before I even have a take.
Certainly helps. Because
until then, I was kind of just like confused and muddled and just trying to understand hell, just mainstream politics and what was happening. And again, it was really confusing because I was still looking at it as a bunch of individuals with their interests and who they following and who they taking money from. And how are they personally influenced?
Yeah.
I think those are the wrong questions at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. The tendency towards individual critique ignores the broader class distinction, certainly. Congratulations on being converted by Big Daddy Engels, the man himself.
Well, it wasn't everything, but I'm trying to reflect on what was it that brought me to my radical, what was my radicalization journey, which we all have various degrees, and some of us have journeys towards reactionary politics.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's something that left Hoovers and people on YouTube try to talk about extensively.
Yeah.
But rarely is there breakdowns of, and some of the YouTubers do talk about how they were radicalized. And it's usually very similar to mine. They just read the little excerpts they were assigned, maybe. Or, you know, another instance was in the college bookstore. I don't know how it got there, but there were copies of Adbusters. And the cop and the front cover, this is like late 2010, was capitalism is the crisis.
Yeah.
And I never thought about capitalism as a system until that point. Mm-hmm. I was still thinking in terms of like liberal economics and stuff.
Yeah.
And what's right or wrong about it. And I was, of course, thinking in terms of systems because I was being educated as an architect. We're always talking about systems and the totality and the whole. You know? And of course, I buy a few issues of Adbusters, and of course they don't have real ads, but they have ads for actions and potential actions that maybe you could undertake. And of course, one of them was take out the trash, occupy Wall Street. So bring it back around.
Oh, cool.
So let's talk about what makes us tired, or particularly a working class person, tired when organizing with middle class comrades. From The Guardian, grassroots organizer Nicole Vosper has been delving into the topic of campaign burnout on her website. In this post, she looks at some of the issues around organizing with middle class comrades. I have many middle class friends and comrades whom I adore. Oh yeah, so she's starting with disclaimer. It's important to flag up that I'm writing this as a white cis woman in England, and I'm aware of the privilege that carries. I'm worried this piece will ignite a backlash, so I'm asking middle-class folks that are triggered by this to perhaps talk to other middle-class people, that's what we're doing, and not email me about it. For once, please just listen and reflect.
It's interesting that she was so worried about backlash, because I think that, you know, this article's largely pretty, I don't know, sensible to me.
It's in The Guardian.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a large newspaper. Also, because I want to be as constructive as possible at the end of the post, yeah, but if you go to an online comment section, you see people who do not want to get the point.
Oh, yeah. The online comment section of any article, you're scraping the bottom of the barrel there.
And this is a nerd culture, too, where they're like shows a political message. Like there's an audience that just doesn't want to get the joke.
Mm-hmm.
Or doesn't understand the political satire that's being communicated. So they just see it and they don't get it. So it's like, this is terrible.
Yeah.
I'm talking about like, Jane Smith's cartoon Neo Yokio comes to mind.
Not familiar, but okay. Point taken.
I love it, but it had anime fans hated it because they didn't get the joke. And the joke is capitalism sucks. What makes me tired when organizing middle class comrades? Talking about the working class as a homogeneous mass, which is what our previous two pieces kind of did, makes me tired. Assuming certain cultural stereotypes of working class people and certain things aren't as annoying. Likewise, talking about working class people like they're scum, cheap, brainwashed masses is patronizing and elitist. Talking about how you can reach out to the working class is also problematic.
That made me really think back to the two articles talking about, oh, we have to go to the masses.
Or find a base.
Yeah. And it's kind of like,
it's still centering like the person, the reader or the writer, as like the someone of the story,
and someone who's not in the masses, like you're trapped in this too, man.
And they realize that too, but they're still thinking like the hero's journey, I guess, instead of like the left as a whole having a hero's journey, which this one writer talking about and culture war stuff, like he put it like the hero's journey ends with like coming home, but
yeah,
having changed after a long journey.
Yeah.
And I feel like the left needs to do that too. Like, we've gone this journey since a century long journey since the Bolshevik Revolution. A lot's happened. A lot hasn't happened. And we need to kind of return home to maybe what leftism was before the Bolsheviks took power and kind of created this schism in leftist culture between taking, say, power outright with a vanguard party.
Yeah.
Versus syndicalist union organizing, and then you do a general strike, which is, and it comes to mind because when I look at successful social movements in the world right now, it's the syndicalist general strikes that are happening. They're not taking over the government, but they're putting such, they're putting immense strain on the machines, of political machines, that they will eventually break down, and they kind of are, in various ways. But they also appear as strong as ever, at least militarily. So it's hard to know what.
Yeah, and you know, as a member of a more of a big tent organization, I definitely advocate employing every tactic and every weapon at once against the capitalist superstructure.
Yeah, the analogy I learned, God, I was still in college. It was 2012, I guess it was during Occupy. Mm-hmm. That it's like you think of the system as a brick wall, and we all got to be hitting it at different places.
Yeah.
You can't just hit it really strong in one place. You maybe hit the hole, but only you can go through that hole.
Yeah, sure, definitely.
On the wall, we all have to be pushing on it. But that kind of entails that we're all in solidarity with each other. We're all ready to collaborate with each other. Mm-hmm. And when I'm out in activist spaces and subculture, I don't see that at all. I see factionalism. I see cliques. And I see, oh no, that what you're doing conflicts with what we're doing because we want to still be friendly with legislators. And you just want to confront them or block traffic.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I definitely see the same hurdles, especially like the, the cliquishness. Unfortunately, activist life is often driven by egos. What you were saying towards like, you know, Albany having a big activist background can be sort of a blessing and the curse in the sense of like, on the one hand, you have a lot of people that are on the same page with you when it comes to like destroying mass incarceration, when it comes to, the essential human needs as human rights. Like these are all like pretty strong points of agreement between all these different factions. But organizing in Albany is often like this alphabet soup of different organizations. And it's great to have that variety of perspectives and all that. But it's sometimes just logistically difficult to find people.
I'll give you an example of why I feel a little cynical or a little bum when talking about the wall analogy. It's why I don't use it normally.
Yeah.
Of course, diversity of tactics and intersectionality and all that. I'm an interdenominational leftist myself. But let's say what happens in real life, the material approach here, we have a meeting on, say, fighting mass incarceration.
Mm.
And there's 10 people in the room. It's a pretty good committee-sized group of people. But then everyone in there either is brought there because of a different section of that, and they want to work on hitting that part of it.
Okay.
Let's say it's fighting the overcharging of families to call their prisoner relatives.
Mm.
Or they just want to focus on banning the box in solitary confinement.
Yeah, both.
And so everyone has their own issue that brought them to that room.
Sure.
And then to add on to that, which of course you just create a platform then, and then that committee has a platform. So that's the simple fix with that side. But the other side then is each of those 10 people have a different favorite tactic they want to use.
Okay.
So one maybe wants to do more direct action,
mm-hmm.
and another wants to lobby.
Yeah.
Another, it's difficult for those 10 people to do all of it.
Yeah.
Unless, and this is what might end up happening, is each person's doing their own tactic, but alone, and then they're back to being alone.
Mm.
And that is failure in my eyes. And that's basically what ends up happening when I go to a meeting of some kind, is the thing that I kind of feel like we should be doing is I end up being alone.
Yeah.
And then I could get dragged into, because like, yes, solidarity, we'll do that tactic.
Mm.
But then we'll keep doing that one tactic, we won't do mine. Or it does split up our energy and resources to do multiple tactics.
Absolutely.
This coalition, whatever it is.
Yeah, and I definitely notice the same thing. I guess what I'd add to that, and like the conclusion I've sort of reached, like, meeting those same barriers and walls, is the activist community, the type of people that, you know, go out in the streets and protest or do your direct action or try to run your campaigns, whatever iteration of that you're doing. I've just noticed it's a narrow range of people. like, I don't know, like, if you look at, say,
professionals.
Yeah.
Professional
if you look at DSA, for instance, nationally, mm-hmm. DSA is the largest socialist organization in the country right now. But we have 60,000 members. In a country with 300 million people, that's nothing. Like, it needs to be to the scale of, like, 10 times that in order for it to be, like, really a serious opposition.
Now, when I hear
my
the factoid of largest socialist organization, like, well, the Green Party has more registered voters.
Right.
But those aren't members, and those aren't, like, our base. Right? Just people with, a preference. They're picking us like they're picking toothpaste.
Yeah.
And that really frustrates me, because, like, I canvassed every Green in Albany and asked them pretty much why you're Green, what do you want us to do as a local?
Mm.
And a lot of them didn't have an answer. Mm. Some just said be more visible, like a toothpaste brand, like just run more ads. And others, it had just picked Green Party because they like the color green.
Yeah, and so like back to your like point of the committee of 10 people, I think the solution to that is like, and to these articles talking about going to the masses or whatever, we just like the solution to me is that we have to drastically expand the amount of people who are involved with this stuff. And of course, that's, you know, of course, easier said than done. But, you know, what like our organization, I think, in order to be effective, needs to be drawing in far more people. So we get to that point where you have your committee of 10, but each person who wants to do an individual tactic has, I don't know, a subcommittee and like enough dedicated people within that that they can actually pursue their ends.
Where Occupy succeeded in that regard was the park occupation brought in a lot of people. So there was step one.
Yeah.
To get you interested. Step two, keep them involved. By inviting people, because every assembly also had like the report backs from each working group.
Mm-hmm.
So you knew what these working groups were doing and what they were about and what kind of tactics or whatever.
Yeah.
Those questions could be answered. And eventually so many working groups, the assemblies go for hours and nobody wanted to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started in the first month, it was 10 and it was very manageable. And I joined the info working group. And so they had a separate meeting, separate from the assemblies, to discuss, you know, what we were doing. And that was great. So you keep people involved with a working group, and there was such a diversity of working groups that then you weren't alone. If you had a particular tactic you liked and a particular cause, there was a working group that had both together.
Right.
Or you could have multiple working groups on the same cause, but then they could split off into their favorite tactics.
Mm-hmm.
Or the working group was 15 people, so you could have groups of 5, and that felt good.
Yeah.
What was missing then was like the base that allowed us to say rent a warehouse to continue mass assemblies or something. There was the idea and the practice of moving the assemblies to different parts of town and having them in different parks.
Yeah.
And particularly Occupy was started by like a group called New York City Assembly, a group of anarchists who do assemblies.
Right.
But their assemblies were a 10-person clique. And then
sure.
They did it as part of a protest action, and then it became a, you know, assembly of 1,000 people. And they did not know how to handle that. It was too much at once.
Yeah.
Which is a question of any organization that, say, starts doing advertising and say, well, let's see if we get all this interest. What do we do with it? How do we bring people in?
Yeah.
What are we working on? You know, the local atheist community, this was a question when there was the question of, like, do we buy a billboard? And it just came down to like, well, we don't really do anything except have basically social meetups.
And not believe in God.
Yeah. So since we're not doing any actual activism because none of us could agree on what kind of activism we do because there are a lot of liberals. And I was basically one of maybe a few. No, I think I'm the only real lefty there. Because I would talk about like how we shouldn't be like saber rattling with Russia. And I was like getting these like greater like red baiting stuff thrown at me. Right. So we have a few minutes left and this article.
Oh yeah, right. The article. Could we skip to the end actually? Because I think that's the most useful part.
Yeah.
Like the
was
author
it the list of things that.
Yeah, the list. Like the author talks a lot about, you know,
what do
things
you do
that
with burnout. Navigating this stuff constantly is exhausting. After talking at length about middle class attitudes and whatnot. Never feeling like you fit in is disempowering, isolating, and alienating, of course. It is hard to feel supported by people who don't share your reality. You lose affinity with people, groups, and networks, and are more likely to burn out and drop out. Finding the state is hard enough without navigating the maze of middle-class entitlement. And as a result, these movements fail to offer me anything that can realistically improve my life or make surviving capitalism easier. Now, this is the way a lot of people with disabilities probably feel about all of the civil society groups that, you know, help them.
Right.
Help them maybe survive, but not really feel like they're living.
Mm.
Like I said at the beginning of the post, I do work with some middle-class comrades whom I adore. I tried to think about what made them different. Here's a list. They are aware of their privilege. Check your privilege. And they're honest about it. They take the piss out of themselves. They don't try to be something they're not. So they don't take themselves too seriously. They know their limitations. They are empathetic, but not judgmental or patronizing. The best service nonprofits are the ones that say, like, we help the homeless in a non-judgmental way.
Yeah.
Because there are too many charities, mostly, you know, parochial ones, who are super paternalistic. And they basically was like, oh, we'll help you, but you gotta do this and this and this.
Solidarity, not charity.
You need a
folks.
Job. You need to be getting a job. You need to learn job skills.
Boo.
Okay. They take risks and do frontline work that threatens their privilege. They don't expect it to be anyone else's responsibility. Likewise, they do the boring behind the scenes work too.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's definitely the things that the author lists here are definitely, things I, strive towards as someone who's definitely a more privileged person in a whole lot of ways. We have a principle in DSA called like step up, step back.
Yeah,
and
that.
the extent to which more privileged people are supposed to step up is when there's an actual array, a civil disobedience action like there was in Troy last summer. More privileged people, since they are less likely to be attacked by the police, for instance, should be the ones who are taking up that kind of line. And, you know, in that action, it was a pretty minimal risk because civil disobedience in New York is not the same thing as civil disobedience in, say, Texas, in the way that the police are going to respond. But it's still a minor risk. So more privileged people should be the ones to step up. The way we're supposed to step back is our voices and in trying to promote
the agenda.
Yeah, to try to promote the voices of, you know, typically more marginalized people, voices that tend to get shut out of things. We're not employing that too well, being two white guys in the podcast right now.
Really,
but
that's a really good. Well, no, this station has plenty of different voices that we'll be featuring.
Fantastic.
They leverage their privilege to support others. That might be lending someone money, giving them a free place to stay for a while. Done that. Or they might be informally mentoring someone to improve their writing. Next, they're aware of their speech and behavior. How they phrase things so they are not offensive. And there's a difference between like kind of policing yourself. This is not to be confused with self-repression becomes mass oppression.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of the assumption that like police, like watch what you say and stuff. Like it's just the feeling is that that's basically repression. And it's not because you're simply taking into account others' feelings and that's not oppression.
Yeah.
They don't dominate meetings or movements or think they have all the answers. They practically support people to participate by being militant that events are structured to support people who get stuck in, like childcare and travel expenses. No one's input is taken for granted.
Goals
oh, yeah, my version of step up, step back is just merely the practical, like, burnout avoidance of if you step up, be a leader, but don't do it for more than a year or half a year. Then step back, let others take charge, don't burn out, and thus, of course, giving others, the more marginalized, a chance.
Yeah.
But of course, being progressive means you let others, the marginalized, take the lead first, and then when they start burning out, then you can take their place, maybe. But that's my compromise towards too many talks that I went to where the line is that the middle-class privileged white guys that's like ourselves should never be leaders. We should never actually speak at all. We should always just be silent supporters of the marginalized.
Well, look, we can't have a perfect world like that always.
Yeah, it just makes me uncomfortable because it just feels so absolutist. And of course, it also is sent telling me to sit down and shut up and just give my money or time.
Yeah.
And then I just feel like an indentured servant to someone who's just, well, understandably more angry they might be. But of course, I'm seething with anger at the system too, which is to say, like, why is your anger more pure? Well, because you've been stepped on harder than me. Okay. So yeah. then it becomes epically gray of like, well, am I just being selfish by saying I want to be a leader sometimes and be a part of the movement and feel mm-hmm. like I'm a part of it? Because when I'm a silent supporter of the marginalized, I don't feel like it's my movement or I'm a yeah. part of it. It's your movement and I'm just helping, which.
Yeah, sometimes that's the role we need to play. I mean, it's a very subtle yeah. distinction, especially when we're talking about, you know, the difference between policing speech and being okay. considerate of other people.
So, but, I just think it's just more contextual. So sure. I'm just going to go a minute over to just remind you that you've listened to the Three Left Show. I'm Dan Platt with Julian Dante.
Hello, hello.
You can find the show podcasted on all podcasting apps, including Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes, et cetera, et cetera. Full archive of 60 episodes is on 3lefts.news. On social media, send us questions, topics you want to discuss, any ideas, Facebook and Twitter, 3leftshow, and support the station. Become a member of WCAALP, The Voice.
Thanks for having me on, Dan. It's been fun.
Have a good one.
Good. Bye now.
All right, that's a wrap.